one of the reasons why we're seeing rent prices decline in parts of the U.S. South and Sun Belt is because those are markets where it's a lot easier to build housing supply. And so the reason rent prices are falling right now is because a lot of supply is coming on the market at the same time that that demand shock that we saw in the pandemic has sort of calmed down. And there's not the same desire to head to the periphery that there was, you know, 3 years ago or so.
Welcome to Sustainability Leaders. I'm Michael Torrance, Chief Sustainability Officer at BMO. On this show, we will talk with leading sustainability practitioners from the corporate, investor, academic, and NGO communities to explore how this rapidly evolving field of sustainability is impacting global investment, business practices, and our world.
The views expressed here are those of the participants and not those of Bank of Montreal, its affiliates, or subsidiaries.
Welcome back to another episode of Sustainability Leaders. I am Alma Cortez Selva, Senior Advisor at the BMO Climate Institute. In today's episode, we will be talking about inflation, housing costs in the US, and extreme weather events. I am joined today by Eric Johnson, Vice President Global Markets Economics at BMO. Thank you so much for coming to the show, Eric. And if you don't mind introducing yourself to the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me here, Alma. I'm an economist with BMO Capital Markets. I'm in our economic research team. You know, I cover a range of different topics, but one of those in particular is, you know, sort of the interface between the macro economy and climate change.
I think our audience will be really interested in talking about inflation, especially since it has eased from recent highs. But what does that mean in terms of what consumers are seeing on the day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so I think inflation is one of these things, one that, you know, certainly really gets, you know, stays on the minds of consumers when they're going to places like the grocery store, say if they're going to fill up their gas tank, all these sort of points of daily contact, they're seeing rapidly changing prices. And I think what's important to recognize here is that what economists or, you know, kind of what statistical agencies around the world try to do when they're measuring something like inflation is they're trying to kind of come up with a proxy for what's happening with, you know, some broad measure of the cost of living. So the idea is like, what's happening for the average household in a society when they're going out and trying to buy all the various goods and services that make up sort of their hypothetical basket of those things that they consume? And the second piece you want to think about there is inflation is really a measure of acceleration or a rate of change and not like a level effect. And so I think there's a few things that matter when you're thinking about what that means on an individual basis in today's economy, particularly in the US. So obviously we've come down tremendously from those, you know, near double digit highs that we saw a little bit more than a year and a half ago now. But if we're thinking about some individual components here, so if we're thinking about how much it costs to, say, buy food at grocery stores today versus the end of 2019, those prices are up 26% or so relative to where they were, you know, almost 4 years ago or a little less than 4 years ago now. And so I think what that is speaking to is that although the rate of change of prices has slowed down, the level effect there is really the challenge that a lot of consumers today are still dealing with. So yes, the rate of change of prices is certainly coming back in line with what we were used to seeing a little bit more. It's still certainly above target, but it's that level effect that doesn't really go away and is what's making this a challenging environment for households to kind of manage in. Everyone's basket is going to look a little bit different. And so when they're going out buying things, paying for services, even if, say, that CPI number is, you know, hovering just over 3%, in respect to what their budget or what their kind of basket looks like, their basket might not be growing in line with what that aggregate measure is showing. And so sometimes that's a little bit of the disconnect that people often feel. You know, a good example is if you're going out to buy a home for the first time, right? You're probably going to think 3% doesn't seem like a fair price increase when you're going to buy, you know, a house that's seemingly rising much more than that from what you might have been used to seeing just by seeing that aggregate statistic there.
You mentioned several of them. You mentioned groceries, you mentioned gas, you mentioned housing. Housing is one of the big ones because it represents a third of the consumer basket. It has gone up almost 6% from the prior year, according to the Department of Labor. What do you think are some of the reasons that we see shelter housing, that inflation persisting, or like it doesn't go down and it remains persistent and high?
Yeah, so shelter is certainly in many ways, one of the most challenging kind of prices out there to measure when we're thinking about these big price indexes like the Consumer Price Index or the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. And, you know, the main difference for why the PCE index is actually, you know, about a percentage point or slightly less than a percentage point lower than the Consumer Price Index is it places a lower weight on shelter. In fact, it places even less than half the weight on shelter than the CPI. And it's just a little bit different about how they're constructed, right? So the PCE is trying to represent all the out-of-pocket and third-party expenditures that go into an economy. So a great example of that is healthcare, right? So if you have health insurance, if you're going to receive a medical service, part of that might be your copay or some other kind of add-on payment you directly have to make. But if your employer provides your health plan, your employer is also paying for that service as well. In the CPI, we don't consider that, but in the PCE, we do. And so that's one of the reasons why in the PCE, some of those other components take up more of that basket than, you know, shelter does in the CPI. So there's just one very simple example of why, you know, shelter prices can have sort of upsize effects on some of these measures and CPI in particular. But another challenge is housing is a little bit different than, say, me going to a grocery store and buying an apple, right? So it's very much a consumable item. The challenge with a house is it's a little bit different than that, right? For, you know, the average home in America is often held for up to 10 years. And there's two various components of that, right? A house primarily, you know, is something that people consume as their means of shelter. But there's this other aspect of it, which is sort of this financial asset or investment tool. And so when we're trying to think about measuring the cost of living in an economy, what the challenge there is we really want to capture that consumable piece of the house without trying to also incorporate this idea that a house is also being an investment vehicle at the same time. And the way that the U.S. has kind of decided to incorporate those costs is basically by thinking about a house as, you know, this rental object. So for people who directly rent, you know, one of the measures that's in the shelter component of CPI is essentially, you know, the average movement of rental prices in the economy. And, you know, it's important to recognize there that there's two very different components of that. So if you were to think about what's happening to, you know, the rental prices for a new tenant, according to the underlying data that the Labor Department uses to build their own shelter CPI measures, is that new tenant price index is actually lower at the end of last year than it was a year ago. And so I think what that's suggesting is that, you know, rental prices actually are turning over in the United States. The challenge is, you know, those are new tenants, and what you want to kind of capture in a broader index is what's happening with everyone, both existing and new tenants. Rather than reflecting maybe what's happening right now, what they're actually reflecting is what might be happening a year ago or sometimes even 18 months ago. And so the reality here is these objects that we put into these price indexes to measure shelter prices are just very slow moving. Because again, if you just look at the average total tenant movement in rental prices, that's still quite elevated, as you were pointing out. Like, it's still, you know, not quite 6%, but it certainly hasn't normalized anything close to kind of the Fed's target of 2%. And so that's one of those components. But I think when you want to think of the overall forces of why, you know, house prices and shelter prices in generally got so upsized in the last few years is, you know, we had at the one hand, this big demand shock for different kinds of space than we were used to seeing demand for, right? So especially at the height of the pandemic, there was this big desire to get out a little bit more into the periphery and even the exurbs of city and get a little bit more space. And the reality is in some markets, there's just not a lot of those properties out there. You know, the challenge is that supply side of the economy isn't really able to respond readily and quickly in a high interest rate environment to kind of meet that imbalance between demand and supply. You know, there's certainly very different versions of that across the country. And one of the reasons why we're seeing rent prices decline in parts of the U.S. South and Sun Belt is because those are markets where it's a lot easier to build housing supply. And so the reason rent prices are falling right now is because a lot of supply is coming on the market at the same time that that demand shock that we saw in the pandemic has sort of calmed down, and there's not the same desire to head to the periphery that there was, you know, 3 years ago or so.
Shifting gears a little bit, we have states like Florida, Louisiana, and California that have become insurance deserts, all due to increasingly devastating extreme weather events. So that makes insurance either extremely expensive or just simply impossible to procure. What effect do you think it's having on homeowners? And is it affecting home prices or like the ability to buy a home?
Yeah. So I think, you know, to tie this back to the conversation we were having earlier, I think one of these things that is also showing up in these price indexes and these measures of the cost of living is what it costs to get insurance today. And so homeownership is a great example of that. Another, you know, thing that's really been affected by the last 3 years is auto insurance as well, right? And so I think what's particularly challenging about home insurance in these markets that are a little bit more affected by some of these physical risks that are sort of starting to rise from climate change is we're adding this additional layer of potential costs. I think there's a few different challenges that's posing. So one, higher prices are meaning that there's, you know, a number of homeowners out there who are canceling their insurance policies because they can't pay for them. And that's, you know, certainly exposing them to huge risk. Something like a hurricane stands out if we're thinking about places in Florida and other parts of the East Coast. I think the challenge is, you know, depending on the market, there's not a lot of definitive research showing great connection between some of these physical risks today and home prices, but we are starting to see some. So there's some research now pointing to exposure to sea level rise being one of those factors that is kind of negatively weighing on home prices if we were going to compare a similar home in an area that's not exposed to sea level rise that has all the kind of same features. So again, I think those things are starting to manifest themselves. And I think as we continue to go forward, we'll start to see things like wildfire risk, drought risk, all these other risks that are associated with some of those physical changes that climate change is bringing to start being capitalized into home prices. Even if you don't live in one of these areas that's a little bit more exposed to something like sea level rise, so you live, you know, more in the middle part of the country, you know, why you should care about that kind of effect is there's two different facets. The way that, you know, insurance products often work, right, is everyone is paying into a pool. And if that pool is continuing to be dominated by these really big events that are happening on the coast because of physical risks of climate change, you know, in essence, you are paying for those things. So even though if you live in, say, Minnesota that might have lower exposure to some of these effects, you might end up having to pay more for your home insurance to make the pool work for an insurance company across the country. And the second piece of it, more from a public financing point of view, is what this is ultimately doing is potentially putting more of the backstop on the American taxpayer, right? So if you have a big disaster and insurance companies have largely walked away from a market, you know, a lot more of that disaster recovery, the replacement of property, a lot of those costs are going to end up falling on, you know, FEMA and other agencies at the federal level and the state level. And yes, maybe that feels a little bit less like it's coming out of your pocket, but, you know, indirectly it is in terms of higher future tax rates. I mean, so I think that's another reason why, you know, everyone in the country should really care about what's happening with these insurance companies stepping away from these markets and just with home insurance prices kind of skyrocketing as they are.
Given all that you mentioned that we see more physical risk coming in from the coast or let's say California wildfires, are we seeing in the data like migration patterns or people moving away from affected areas to safer states or not yet?
So I'd say there's two challenges to this. So one, it just so happened that the pandemic shock over the last kind of 4 years when we're thinking about what it meant for migration patterns in the US is you naturally had an outflow from really expensive markets to markets that have a little bit better housing affordability. So people were, you know, leaving places like the Bay Area and going to different parts of Arizona. And so that does look a little bit like that, even if it's not directly reflective of the underlying, say, physical risk. But, you know, I think we are seeing some of that a little bit more today in communities that were sort of devastated, let's say, by big wildfires. But certainly, if you look at some of the historical studies, there, you know, isn't as much evidence to suggest that there's a huge migration response in the US so far to some of these bigger physical risks. But I think you're going to continue to see those go up as we head into the next, you know, kind of several years here. Because again, I think, you know, the challenge with climate change here is not that, you know, you just get volatility, is that you're going to continue to see kind of these effects that we've had, you know, in the last several years, not just continue, but some in many ways intensify.
Extreme weather events have also been cited by multiple research articles as one of the factors that exacerbate inflation. How are extreme weather events affecting or impacting the supply chain and the production in the US? And then what has happened in the last few years? Do you mind going over a little bit? Because we saw the impact on housing, but it seems that there's more that extreme weather events impact production, impact the supply chain.
Absolutely. So I think we already touched on this a little bit. Like, you know, one of the very direct ways that physical risk events are changing the cost of living for people is what's happening with things like home insurance markets or even auto insurance markets, right? It's making these things that much more expensive and, you know, just that much more difficult to offer as a risk sharing product. And so I think that's going to be something that is here to stay and in many ways could get worse as we go forward. But I think there's a longstanding research line that focuses on the relationship between kind of extreme heat days and, you know, labor productivity. And so I think a challenge that we're going to have to continue to deal with is the more of these summers that we have to deal with where we get, you know, not just one-off heat waves, but sustained heat waves, you know, those are kind of things that very much weigh on labor productivity, particularly for jobs that have to work outside and aren't in, you know, fully air-conditioned spaces the whole time. And so that's one of the very direct ways which we can see physical risk kind of manifesting itself as higher inflation in the future. Just by lowering productivity, it means we're going to be spending more money to produce the same things. And, you know, if we want to tie it back to housing supply, you know, one of the very important jobs that we're going to need to, you know, continue to ramp up here in the United States over the next several years is housing construction. And housing construction is largely a job that happens outside, especially in the initial phases of any big project. And so the more extreme heat days we have in the summer, that's certainly going to limit how much we can do on the housing supply side. And so again, that's something that very much feeds into that supply chain and, you know, can potentially raise the future costs of any of those kind of projects in the future.
We have the Inflation Reduction Act in the U.S. Has it been playing a role in reducing inflation? I know it's been very important as a climate legislation. Was it designed to reduce inflation or for some other impact?
I mean, I feel like the Inflation Reduction Act is in some ways like a poorly named bill. I think it's, you know, certainly if you're interested in federal climate legislation, it is by far the most impressive piece of legislation that has ever made it into law in the United States. And certainly it is already having dramatic impacts on the amount of clean technology investment in the United States and will continue to do that. But if we want to think of like the near-term effects of the bill on inflation, generally one of the potentially big drivers of inflation in any, you know, large economy is what's happening between the overall balance in an economy between aggregate demand, so all of the things that people want to buy out there, and aggregate supply. So basically how much we can produce as an economy. And one of the certainly features of the US over the last several years, and we can go back even further than that, is that generally, you know, the federal government in particular has been a little bit more on the largesse side, right? We're running pretty significant deficits relative to GDP. And in an environment where demand is diminished, that's actually a great thing, right? So if we're in the midst of a recession, typically a very good Keynesian response to that recession is for the government to sort of be this spender of last resort and go out there and stimulate the economy and, you know, kind of pump demand enough so we don't end up with as bad of a down cyclical event as we would otherwise. The challenge is right now, you know, the U.S. economy is actually operating what you'd argue is above capacity, right? You know, GDP growth is in the U.S. is, you know, quite above trend. You know, we ended last year above 2% growth. We just revised the last quarter up of 2023 to 3.4% growth annualized in the US. So again, that's certainly an economy that's humming along, that, you know, consumers are out there spending, you know, certainly a lot on consumable things. And so if on top of that, if the government's also spending a lot of money, that's generally going to put more pressure on inflation than less pressure on inflation. And so because of how generous some of these provisions are for clean technology, you know, a lot of the initial estimates of the cost of the IRA were in that, you know, $350 to $400 billion range over kind of the next, I guess, what, 7 years or so by 2031. But now, you know, just the uptake has been so tremendous. And I think if you are interested in the clean technology future of the United States, this is a fantastic news piece. But certainly if you're interested in the near-term budget balance, maybe less of a, you know, less of a high point for you. But, you know, cost estimates have roughly doubled for the IRA. So they're now, you know, running more in the $780 to, you know, $800 billion range. And so on the near term, right, that's probably, if we're to classify it as being inflationary or deflationary, we'd probably classify it as being inflationary. But I think if you're wondering why you would call something like the Inflation Reduction Act exactly that name, is if we're projecting out where the U.S. economy is going to be in, say, 2030 or and beyond. You know, one of the key components of getting any economy right now to something that's a little bit more aligned with a net zero pathway is, you know, an electrification process. So a lot of the primary energy system in the United States is today reliant on fossil fuels. And so if we want to shift it to one that's using a lot more electrification as opposed to fossil fuel based for primary energy, you need to build that capacity. And so that's one of the things the IRA is certainly starting to deliver right now and will become even more evident, you know, 5 to 10 years from now. And so I think what you want to think about is what is the IRA potentially going to do to electricity prices and, you know, just energy costs generally, you know, say by 2030. The nice thing about some of these, you know, renewable technologies or some of the other kind of energy systems out there is they act a little bit more like what we might call a technology, you know, cost curve. So generally what you see, let's say computers are a perfect example of this, is initially these things are very expensive, but over time we just get much better at making them and much more efficient at kind of delivering the same amount of computational power in the sense of a computer, but in electricity system, you know, the amount of energy delivered for, you know, kind of every solar panel we're using or every turbine we're putting up. And so that's the, you know, the advantage of something like the IRA, right? We're shifting the electricity system to something that's potentially going to be less tied to a commodity cycle. And so in generally can deliver not just, you know, predictable energy prices, but lower energy prices if we kind of build the capacity there for it. When we're projecting out, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, that I think is the potential deflationary effect of something like the IRA, right? It's about spending a little bit more now to build the capacity to, you know, build a more kind of predictable and technology-oriented kind of energy system that, you know, hopefully kind of delivers some of these technological progress on the cost side that, you know, let us produce, you know, more electricity than we're using today, but at, you know, a lower overall cost. So I think that is the upside and maybe, you know, why kind of that name got thrown out. But certainly, like, if you're thinking of your immediate, you know, what is it doing for me today for, you know, my electricity prices or for the cost of some things, not that much, unless you want to go out and buy an electric vehicle, in which case it is actually doing certainly a lot in the sense that if you're buying an electric vehicle today, you can get up to $7,500 off the purchase price. And, you know, there are some restrictions on, you know, country of origin and some of the technologies that go into that electric vehicle. But if you want to lease that vehicle, there's, you know, a lot fewer restrictions that come with that. So that would be maybe the one thing I would point to. It is certainly lowering the price right now if you want to go out and buy an electric vehicle today.
Now, again, thinking big picture, what do you think we can expect for inflation for 2024 overall? Because you guide us a little bit 5 years, 10 years, what the Inflation Reduction Act may do. But what can we expect for 2024?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, listen, there's good news for consumers and certainly businesses going ahead for 2024. So I think, yes, the first 2 months of this year, we've seen, you know, a little bit more volatile and upside surprises on inflation than we were expecting. But I think the broad takeaway here is that we're continuing on this, I guess we'll call it slow, but, you know, sustained journey towards inflation coming back closer to something we're used to seeing. So something a little bit closer to the Fed's 2% target. And, you know, I think 1 or 2 months at the start of the year aren't really going to jeopardize that progress, but I think it is going to be a little bit of a slow grind. So if we think of some prices are certainly slowing down. So food at home prices are certainly falling already below target. Food away from home, so that's like when we go out and eat at restaurants, are still a little bit above target, but those have started to fall meaningfully as well. So I think what we're likely to see is some of those, you know, kind of prices really start to turn over by the end of this year. And so certainly in our view, you know, we'll be, at least CPI will come under 3% by the end of this year. And, you know, we'll be back, you know, a little bit closer to what we'd expect changes in inflation to be as we head into 2025. Now, core inflation is going to be a little bit slower moving. But again, I think core inflation is one of those things that is going to start to turn over as we get to the latter half of this year. And again, it comes back to shelter, right? So part of the benefit or the downside of shelter being this really backward looking object in these price indexes is, you know, by the time you get to the second half of this year, that's a period of time that starts to have much better base effects if we go back, you know, a year or we go back 16 months. And so that's something that's going to start to really benefit those headline series.
That sounds like good news for us consumers. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that certainly the challenge for this year is going to be this like delicate balance between trying to thread the needle of slowing down the US economy a little bit because it's still running hot. At the same time, you know, we don't want to slow it down too much to the point that we end up with, you know, something that looks much less like a soft landing and more like a hard landing. And so I think that's the delicate balance that, you know, certainly central bankers are having to walk both globally and in the US. And I think if you're, you know, staring out there into the world and trying to figure out what, you know, the Fed is looking at, I would say, you know, certainly looking at where the next, you know, kind of CPI and PCE kind of price index reports come in, that's really going to be the key thing they're going to look at as we go forward, just in the sense that, you know, a lot of those real economic measures continue to outperform, you know, most people's expectations. And so really what we want to see is just more and continued sustained progress on some of those consecutive, you know, CPI reports we'll see over the next few months. And if you start to see, you know, those meet or even exceed people's expectations for where prices could turn over, then I think that's a world where you should be a little bit more confident that the Fed's going to go out there and start to cut rates in the second half of this year.
It sounds like good news to me. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode where we reviewed the expected trends of inflation and housing for this year in the US. Thank you so much, Eric. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Alma. Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for listening to Sustainability Leaders. This podcast is presented by BMO. You can find our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. Press the follow button if you want to get notified when new episodes are published. We value your input, so please leave a rating, review, and any feedback that you might have, or visit us at BMO.com/sustainability leaders. Our show and resources are produced with support from BMO's marketing team and Puddle Creative. Until next time, thanks for listening and have a great week.
For BMO disclosures, please visit bmocm.com/podcast/disclaimer.